This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, on podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Land Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher. You'll notice I'm not Shane Gallagher. He's unexpectedly not here today, so we're winging it. But that's okay. I'm Samuel Mann. And tonight's guest is Dr. Marcel Dawson, who is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Otago. Her work straddles the disciplines of sociology and politics. Her main area of interest is the study of social movements, activism and popular protest. Her research to date has focused primarily on South Africa, where she's from, and she's published on popular resistance against privatisation, the policing of protest, social movements and citizenship, movement ideologies, knowledge production and social movement, movements, the use and production of media by social movements and the ethics involved in activist research. She's currently researching resource scarcity and community resistance, and in June she's co-directing the Otago Foreign Policy School, the theme of which is Global Resource Scarcity, the Catalyst for Conflict or Collaboration. We've got a lot to talk about. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Sam, and thanks for inviting me to be on the show this evening.
That's all right, anytime. So, South Africa, you grew up in South Africa?
Yes, in Johannesburg.
What was it like?
Hot, much hotter than Dunedin. it's one of those things. I think it doesn't get a lot of good press. So crime levels are high. We do definitely see that. And also, as you would have mentioned, my interest in protest. We definitely saw a lot of protest happening in Johannesburg. But other than that, it is a beautiful place to visit and wonderfully seasonably warm all year round.
And what did you do your undergrad studies in?
In sociology at the University of Johannesburg. Well, at that stage it was Rand Afrikaans University.
And what led you to do that?
Probably it was default at the time. I don't think I had a particular reason for studying sociology, but gradually as I continued with an honours and a master's, it was just understanding society and understanding how people work with one another, what motivates their ability to work together or why they were coming into conflict. And as you mentioned, I have a particular interest now in popular resistance. So it was really, growing up under apartheid where, conflict was almost inevitable. I was quite interested to then see it in the post-apartheid context, that people were still on the streets, still rioting, and this is what really drove me to my current interest in popular resistance.
What did you do your PhD on?
I was on a social movement, so an activist organization that operated in South Africa called the Anti-Privatization Forum. And in particular, I was interested in their resistance efforts against the commodification of water. As I sort of saw these protests happening on the streets, I was quite interested in why people were still so angry under a post-apartheid democratic government. And what I saw happening out on the streets was that, people wanted access to basic services. So the services that had been denied under apartheid, like water, electricity, those sorts of things, people were still clamoring to have access to those services. And I think in the media, many of those protests were dubbed as service delivery protests. And then there was a backlash, people saying, oh, constantly people want things and want handouts from the government. But actually what was underlying their motivations was really a desire to be heard. to be able to say, look, we want access to water, and we'd also like to say how we would like that access to be delivered, or how we would like to get access. Because what we saw happening in the post-apartheid period was service delivery through commodified means. So people, poor people, were now being expected to pay up front for things like water and electricity. So in the same way that we might use a prepaid telephone service, you know, buying credit in advance, very poor people in South Africa were expected to do the same, that they would buy the credits and then use water, and if they ran out, they would have to top up. So really, for me, what was underlying those protests was an issue of democracy, that people were not being heard, and their request for things like access to basic services was being done in a way that for them and their livelihoods was not sustainable.
What was the driver from the people that were making those changes?
It was largely driven by cost recovery. You know, under the apartheid system, a lot of that infrastructure was not there. So the new government had to put a lot of that infrastructure in, and to recover the costs, they were then charging the end user. But interestingly, the same sorts of measures didn't really apply to wealthy people who had always been on the service grids and who paid for whatever they'd used at month end. So, you know, it was this sort of discrepancy between the rich and the poor, where poor people were now being expected to pay up front. So what really drove it was the cost recovery, very neoliberal modes of thinking about getting people to access things like basic services, water and electricity.
It's interesting, those things, because they're services, but they're not free to produce.
No. And certainly in my doctoral work, people expressed a willingness to pay for a service, but they weren't willing to buy water. And it was so interesting that, you know, just the wording that they'd used about paying for a service that was delivered. And most people, you know, no matter how poor, they were willing to pay for a good service. They weren't willing to buy water up front. And I found just, you know, that usage of the words buying and paying quite interesting in my work, that it wasn't just an absolute rejection of paying for anything. They were more than willing to pay for a reliable service.
How are they getting water before?
Communal taps. So, and it was often women who would have to walk long distances and collect up large buckets of water that they then have to carry those long distances back to their homes. Under the apartheid era, there were also rent and service boycotts. So a lot of people were still getting water but not paying. So there were service and also payment backlogs.
And was there with that paying up front, was there a social net? But if you ran out of water, what happened next?
Yeah. People would often go to neighbours in the same way, you know, might knock on somebody's door to ask for a cup of sugar or something. People, and particularly with water, they would exchange services in that way. And that was another interesting thing that came out in my research, that under the commodified service provision, people were far less willing to do that because they were worried that their households would run out and wouldn't then be able to you know, help out a mate. And that ruined the community fabric to quite a large degree. And I work particularly in Soweto, but this was happening in other townships across South Africa as well, that the community fabric started to fray because they were now no longer able to help each other out.
What are the alternative models of water delivery and paying for it? If they're protesting against that, was there a proposed alternative?
Some of it was about free basic water, and there is an allocation of a certain amount of free basic water that is given out by the government. But that didn't really meet people's demands. There were also demands for being treated in the same way that wealthier people were being treated. So to get a bill at the end of the month and then pay for that.
And was the logic for not doing that because those wealthier people already had the infrastructure. They weren't having to do cost recovery
on
that.
Yeah, they weren't having to put in new pipes and things to service the power in houses.
That seems to question sort of ideas of equity. Is that not... Does that not wave big red flags? I was just wondering how that happened.
Yeah, well, I think you're amongst several people who wonder how that actually happens, how wealthier and poor people get treated so differently by supposedly a democratic system. And you speak about equity, and South Africa is one of the most unequal countries in the world, this is constantly what is fueling a lot of the anger and a lot of the street demonstrations and protests, etc., that 20 years after apartheid, there is still such a massive discrepancy between rich and poor.
Is it ever going to go away?
Hard to say. It's not going to disappear overnight, and perhaps some would argue that 20 years of democracy is quite a short lifespan of democracy, and I guess in the history of the world it is. But for some people in South Africa, they will never have a job in their entire lifetimes, will never work. The unemployment figures are incredibly high. And I don't think inequality is going to change under a neoliberal mode of government. So I think capitalism thrives on inequality, and if we have that governing service provision, then I don't think those disparities will.
What are the numbers like in terms of how many people are in that position? Is it a straight? Okay, it's not officially apartheid anymore, but it's essentially the same in terms of the balance of people?
Largely so, although there's been a growth in the black middle class and also black billionaires. So what we would have seen under apartheid is a massive discrepancy between black and white. We now see that in terms of rich and poor. And there's a bigger class divide, I guess, between rich and poor than between blacks than between blacks and whites. So for me, the biggest fault line in South Africa today is class rather than race.
And we see that in anything that is scarce and has to be managed. So we've talked about the water, electricity, education.
Education as well. Access has opened up, but highly unequal access, privatized education. So it's the same sorts of arguments, I guess, that underpin things like basic services.
You're saying that I'm afraid I have almost no knowledge of South African government, but you're saying it's a neoliberal approach of both sides of the house. In that sort of on that side of things, or is there a?
I mean, in a way, it's a one party democracy, and I mean, I guess I should be a little bit cautious, and I shouldn't call it. It's not neoliberal in the sort of sense that we see it happening elsewhere in the Western world. There are certain social democratic aspects to the government. I would probably sort of take back the expression of complete neoliberal approaches, but certainly we've definitely seen an attempt under the ANC to privatize a lot of these services or commodify these services, which has not had a very good outcome for poor people.
Are those patterns common across the rest of Southern Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to really speak about the rest of Southern Africa. It's not necessarily something I'm familiar with. Certainly levels of inequality in South Africa are higher than in most other African countries.
Is that level of inequality sustainable?
Difficult question. you know, at the human level, it's not. You know, it's I don't really see how this level of inequality can persist. You know, I mean, South Africa's just recently had an election, and again, the African National Congress has come out on top. You know, I think what really is necessary for things to change politically in South Africa is a party that is significantly going to challenge the ANC. At the moment, it's got a very weak, you know, the official opposition is quite weak in terms of the support that it draws. The unions are tied into an alliance with the ruling party, which I think is particularly dangerous. And until we see a shift there and a party that can actually stand up against the ANC, I think things will remain the same for the foreseeable future. So that sort of political shift needs to happen before anything changes. I don't think it'll change under an ANC government.
You talk about the policing of protest, and South Africa has got a long history of brutal policing of protest. Is it carrying on that way?
Certainly, it is. And you know, this is something that again was quite alarming. Some of the images that we would have seen on the news and in the media sort of harked straight back to apartheid South Africa of police cracking down on demonstrators, and people have the right to protest, you know, and it was quite shocking, some of the sort of scenes of torture and brutality that were effected against protesters.
Why? It seems I'm not sure what the appropriate literary reference to use is, but It seems crazy that something that's born of protest, once you're in power, is to, you know, change clothes and carry on pretty much like it was before.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it sort of comes down to that saying about absolute power corrupts absolutely. And in many ways, being a one-party democracy, or dominant, I should say, dominant party democracy, I think the ANC has sort of been allowed to carry on as it wishes. For me, the issue is certainly, as I said before, that it doesn't have a strong challenger where it's had to really reconsider its policies and how it treats the populace.
So you've been in New Zealand for a couple of years?
That's right.
What brought you here?
It was largely my partner. who also works at the University of Otago. And, I think after 2 years of long distance, we just kind of figured it made sense for me to come over. So I was fortunate enough to have an opportunity to teach in the Department of Sociology.
And you teach, I've got the list here, you teach cultural and social identities, sociology research and sociological theory. What do you teach in the cultural and social identities? Can you give us 101 or F102? Can you give us cultural and social identities 101 in a 102 in a very short space?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of partly how people become members of society, and so it's the interface between the individual and society, and what sort of structural factors shape identities, and what internal individual factors shape our identity. So we look at things like race and the social construction of race, the stuff on language. Also do a lecture on body art and how much body art is a part of culture and tradition, and how much it is really part of an individual expression of identity. But it's really the interface between the self and society.
Is society, I mean, society is made up of individuals, but is it a whole is worth more than the sum of the parts?
Yeah, that sort of gestalt principle that as individuals we can only do so much, but that collectively societies are, as you say, greater than the sum of their parts.
Greater than in a larger sense, not necessarily better?
I would say, collectively, if societies act collectively, I think they are better rather than going after individual interests And again, just, you know, I see that happening far too often, that a lot of what gets done is for individual interest rather than collective benefit.
And in fact, we have people talking about New Zealand Inc., almost denying that there is a society. It's treating the country as a business.
As a brand, yeah, yeah.
And the underlying principle being rational economic thought.
Yeah.
Is that dismissed in sociology, or is it sort of put to one side and we're talking about people rather than consumers?
No, I mean, we address it in the sense of, you know, we ask the question about how to shift that back, that now we see it at the university as well. The students are the clients. We are the service providers, you know, so that sort of ideology permeates a lot of what we do in society. And I think, you know, the role of sociology is to remind people about collective benefits and how we can all benefit from acting collectively rather than through or being driven by individual self-interest.
Are you telling me that the whole science, that the purpose of the science is about, is it science?
It's a social science.
It's a social science. is about promoting collective benefits. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't necessarily think all my colleagues would agree with me. I wouldn't want to reduce it to that sort of a definition. My own work is certainly driven by wanting to show people or to explain to students the benefits of acting collectively and how that strengthens society and how, as individuals, we can all benefit from that rather than just some people succeeding while others trail behind.
Is the reason for acting like that because the benefits come back to us, or is there inherent benefit in behaving that way just for the greater good?
I mean, I guess a bit of both. That benefit by all of us acting collectively, that the benefits that get born out of that collective action or acting collectively or in ways of solidarity, that those benefits do come back to the individual.
Because I'm just thinking of things like, we were talking about resources, and lots of the resources of interest are resources that are commons. And so if we've got resources which are communally owned and the society is managing them in terms of a sort of altruistic, all working together, where do I fit into that? Am I sort of like a worker ant within that?
Yeah, I mean, if you sort of take the example of the sale of state-owned assets, for instance, you know, for me, I mean, I can understand sort of why it was done, but the fact that that is now no longer something that is New Zealand, that now people, individuals, are having to buy back their stake or their share in something that is or should be a state-owned asset. You know, I mean, I don't sort of want to pretend as though I'm some kind of expert on New Zealand, but it's that sort of argument for me, that something that is collectively owned now gets sold off. And if you want a stake in it, you've got to buy it back individually. I don't see that as being very sustainable for nations.
I agree with you, but it's not as if they can take it away. It's still there.
It's there, but now I guess only owned by some people, so some can benefit from it.
But if you think that you can't take it away when you die, does it matter if somebody else owns it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you put it that way. But I you know, what is now the benefit for New Zealand as a whole?
We've talked to Alan Mark and recently to Murray Harris about sort of land management.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought me to thinking about the state of the High Country and who runs the High Country and who owns it. And we were talking at work today about the sort of tenure reform and who owns those big blocks of land and if they've looked after it, as far as they're concerned, perfectly well for 100 years, why does, you know, now the government, you know, wants to take it off them to look after it, but they've been looking after it. The fact that the tussocks and things are real small and they should be real big is something else. So I was just sort of thinking about I find it sort of almost quite abhorrent that we're being asked to buy something that we already own. Mm-hmm. But I'm just trying to sort of explore in my head what are the counter arguments to that. And do you think that there is good counter arguments to it?
I mean, I guess if we had an economist on the show, you know, they could sort of plot out the arguments. I think it's certainly worth thinking about. I don't sort of think I can give you an answer off the top of my head, but certainly both sides of the argument need to be thought through. And again, it just sort of comes down to, I don't understand why something that was collectively owned, is now having to be bought back on an individual basis.
Some people, of course, think that anything that the government does is necessarily bad, or at least is impinging on their rights to do whatever it is that they want to be able to do. So anything that the government is, you know, the government can't possibly own that and manage it better than commercial interests could. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I've also been thinking about is how our society has managed to split itself up into so many bits. And the thing which listeners will remember that I talk about quite a lot is the cycleway out mm-hmm. to Sawyers Bay, where I live. And we wouldn't need the cycleway if they'd get the logging trucks off the road. Right. And the cycleway, the logging trucks are going along beside a perfectly good railway.
Yes.
And it just seems so bizarre that we've got these logging trucks on the road when there's a railway there. But mm-hmm. the problem is that our society has managed to split itself up, so it's separated the costs and the benefits and who's paying for what. Mm-hmm. And so it would cost whatever it is, $2,000 more or whatever it is, sorry, $2 million more to get the logs onto the rails.
Yeah.
And most of that cost would be borne by a city council that's managed to separate itself off from the company that's going to do that, separately from the local and national government that would have to is paying now for fixing the roads because of things. And I'm just trying to understand why society, it does that. Why does it split itself up so that it can't actually think as a whole?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Rhetorical question, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's something that bears thinking about to ask that question about why.
So how would a sociologist approach that question?
I guess it's going to take longer than just sort of one sort of radio insert to get to the bottom of it. I think in reality for sociologists to address that question and realize that is part of the problem of this sort of compartmentalization of society is at least a starting point. I'm not really sure I could answer you in a short space of time.
Okay, so let's talk about the Otago Foreign Policy School, which is on in a month's time.
Yes.
Who have you got coming?
Oh, we've got a top line of speakers. I'm very excited that we're hosting Dave Tickner, who's Chief Freshwater Advisor at the WWF in the UK, and he's one of our keynote speakers. And we also have Kuntala Lahiri Dutt, who is the second keynote speaker, who's based at Australian National University. I don't necessarily want to go through a whole sort of list of speakers, but some really quite top names in water and other resources.
So the tagline is global resource scarcity, catalyst for conflict or collaboration.
Yeah.
So what sorts of resources are we talking about that are scarce? Is it the ones we've been talking about? Is it water?
And I think, you know, we sort of have to look at New Zealand's position in this and then also globally. I mean, certainly my own interest in this topic was fueled by a wider interest in water and how scarce globally water resources are. If we sort of look at the world's water, about 97 or 98% of the world's water is ocean. So, you know, undrinkable really, and not really fit for use for agriculture. And I know there've been talks about desalination as an option, but, you know, I just don't see how that is really environmentally sustainable. So a key question for me is really how can the world better manage this very small supply of fresh water so that it is affordable and accessible to all? But then if we flip it and look at it from New Zealand's point of view, I mean, certainly when we first started discussing this, if listeners don't know, the Foreign Policy School is really run as a training workshop for the new crop of MFAT interns. So this is something that we do in collaboration with MFAT, and certainly the view of MFAT and the Ministry for the Environment was that water is not a foreign policy issue for New Zealand. And I was quite astounded by that stance. And the reasons I was given was that New Zealand is water abundant, it doesn't share its boundaries with any other country, so therefore there would be no transboundary water conflicts as there are in other regions, you know, Latin America, the Middle East, and elsewhere. And that is certainly true. But I also think that it's quite a narrow approach to understanding water as a foreign policy issue. I mean, if we just had to take water and agribusiness in New Zealand, for instance, you know, if we look at dairy farming, and again, it's not as though I'm an expert on New Zealand, but dairy is one of New Zealand's major exports. And in a recent report from the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, they looked at the issue of changing land use. And the argument there is that more and more tracts of land are being used for dairy farming at the expense of other things like sheep farming and forestry. And the point that they were really making in this report is that that changed use of land has a knock-on effect on how many pollutants are then in the drinking water. And so to me, you know, because of dairy and that it is one of New Zealand's major exports, we have to understand water as part of foreign policy. And then also, you know, there's the issue of the Pacific Island countries. Just recently, New Zealand has given, I think it's in the region of $5 million to the SPC, the Secretariat of the Pacific Community, to carry out a project that looks to increase the quality of drinking water security in a number of Pacific Island countries. So, you know, in that sense, I do see water in the New Zealand context being quite a distinctive foreign policy issue. And I think New Zealand has quite a big role to play as far as water diplomacy is concerned in the Asia-Pacific region. They are also, you know, after I was told this by MFAT and the Ministry for the Environment, we sort of went back to the drawing board and had a look at what other kinds of resources we would want to speak about, and certainly there are other resources, other natural resources that are on the foreign policy agenda of New Zealand. I mean, Dunedinites will remember that, you know, Anadarko has just sort of recently left our shores after their efforts to drill a test well just off Otago's coast in the hope that they were going to strike natural gas. And I guess it raises this issue about, you know, is being a resource-abundant nation a blessing or a curse? And for many, it is seen as a blessing, particularly entrepreneurs. But for others, you know, environmentalists in particular, it's seen as a curse. So, you know, deep sea mining is something that will be discussed at the conference. I know, for instance, that the people in the wood industry are particularly keen on the conference. They're concerned about the fact that the forestry industry is being swamped by China's demand for unprocessed logs from New Zealand. And meanwhile, alongside that, New Zealand's manufacturing industry is being hollowed out, and this is certainly a concern for people in the wood processing industry. And we have Philippa Brandt from the Lowy Institute in Sydney, who will be addressing the question of China's quest for natural resources in the Pacific or Pacific region.
I want to take you up on that question, though. Is being resource abundant nation, is being a resource abundant nation a blessing or a curse? I can think that you'd have to be a resource abundant nation to even consider that question.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And New Zealand certainly is in that position. You know, I guess the other thing that we're trying to explore at the conference is this notion that competition for scarce resources is necessarily going to have a conflictual outcome. Certainly, I mean, something was printed in the ODT yesterday using the headline, "Tension is the focus of the foreign policy school." And that's certainly not the case. You know, in particular, what we're trying to do at the school is also look to how nations can engage collaboratively to address the issue of dealing with scarce resources.
It's all right saying that you should be engaging collaboratively unless you're Cambodia and your neighbours upstream are putting up a dam. There's not much you can do about it, is there? I mean, that's a very scarce resource.
Yeah.
And there's forgotten how many million people it is living off the protein from the river. Including some of the people that will benefit from it in wherever it is. And is it Thailand that wants the power, but they're going to lose some of the water themselves? Is that the sort of question that...
Yeah, I'm not denying the evidence of conflict altogether. You know, certainly there is conflict. I mean, we just sort of look around the world and take oil, for instance, and we know that there is conflict around the world about over natural resources. What I am saying, though, is that it's not the only response, and these are just some of the things that we will want to think about at the conference. You know, if we take something, a different kind of resource, rare earth elements, something that is being demanded from the New Zealand side that we don't really have, or not really abundant, in terms of having rare earth elements. And China, I think, has about 90% of the world's rare earth elements. So these are the little things that we use in all these high-tech gadgets. And now that there's obviously this interest in this, we're finding more and more deposits all over the world. I think Afghanistan has quite a lot of the rare earth deposits as well. And this certainly changed the supply chain. We have a speaker who is based at the Institute for Security and Development Policy in Sweden, Elliot Brennan, who will be discussing the issue of rare earth elements as one of Asia's critical resources. And in particular, he's wanting to focus on emerging international cooperation rather than conflict over the rare earth supply chain. So I guess, you know, what I'm saying is that where we have an issue of either abundant or scarce resources, that the approach is not always about conflict, and that there are ways, I think, that nations can can engage collaboratively over these issues.
What's the role of free trade in that?
I think it will be discussed in coming up at the conference. One of the speakers, Nick Main, will talk about water and business opportunities. I'm not really an expert on free trade, so I wouldn't want to really speak about that.
Does the scarcity of resources not necessarily lead to conflict, but does it necessarily lead to equity problems?
I mean, I guess it's a question of how the resources are managed. I'm just sort of thinking about how to address this. I think it does raise. I mean, there are going to be nations who have more access, so certainly that they're going to be geographical inequities in that sense.
But I'm thinking if we push it to the extreme, and we could take it back to your work in Soweto, there's no issues over access to air. Although I've just thought of the example where there is access a problem in China itself, where the air is getting polluted.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone's still breathing the same air, I suppose. So there aren't equity issues in that area. Is there a level at which the amount of something leads to people wanting to commodify it or wanting to sell it? Is there a relationship between that and equity?
Sorry, Sam, I'm just not sure. No, that's okay.
I was just wondering if scarcity necessarily leads to inequity. Can you manage a scarce resource in an equitable way? And the examples that you've talked about are where things are scarce. If we take the water supply in South Africa, then that scarcity, if water was already at every house in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't be an issue because it would already be there.
Mm-hmm.
There might then be the issues that you're talking about how rich people pay for it differently from poor people, but it might not be as much of a problem.
Yeah, I guess if nobody was lacking that resource, but still, if you sort of compare how wealthy and poorer people are using the water, certainly the people in Soweto are not using water to fill up their swimming pools or run their household irrigation systems and things like that. So I guess the question is also about usage and sustainable usage of the resource. But certainly, if it was not lacking, I don't necessarily think people would be out on the streets clamoring for all of these things.
And identifying what people have or nations have and is their unique selling point gives them the basis of their economy, which keeps their society afloat. So is that part of that response that you're talking about how the competition for scarce resources doesn't necessarily lead to conflict because it could be the basis of the systems that we're operating?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that in many cases the resource itself is I mean certainly in South Africa the minerals would be what is largely holding up the economy. Um,
So the foreign, what's it called, the Foreign Policy School, when is that? That's in June. It's not open to the public, is it?
It is open to the public. Yeah. Yes, it is open to the public, and so the registration details are available on the website.
And that's www.otagoacnz/otagofps.
Yeah, I mean, I think if people sort of looked up Otago Foreign Policy School, they'd come across the website, so that there'd be all sorts of details there, including the registration details.
What's the talk you're most looking forward to?
Gosh, well, there are many, actually. I mean, I am quite excited to hear David Tickner speak, who, as I mentioned, is the freshwater advisor at the WWF. But I'm also quite interested to hear Yosefa Mayava from the UN Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, who is going to reflect on the post-2015 development challenges in relation to the Millennium Development Goals. We're obviously nearing 2015, and he'll be addressing, you know, what happens beyond 2015 in terms of those MDGs that were set, and he'll relate it specifically to the issue of natural resources. In addition to the individual speakers, we also have a couple of roundtable discussions, one being on the foreign policy implications of global resource depletion, and the other one will look at collaborative resource management. And water will be a particular focus of that second panel, but we're going to explore resource ownership and collaborative water governance on day two of the conference.
We've talked a bit about activism. Do you consider yourself to be an activist yourself?
Yes, I would.
Why is that?
I think, you know, just sort of in terms of speaking out against things, but, you know, it's not always necessarily getting out on the streets, but just, you know, voicing your opinion when things are wrong, rallying. And again, it comes back to my principle of rallying people and getting some kind of solidarity going, that it's, I think far too often, problems or concerns are individualized and we try to deal with them as individuals, but it's quite difficult to challenge a system as an individual. And so my involvement in that, or my the ideological basis, I guess, for me is just that we're far stronger when we act collectively. So
do you think we're training people to be activists?
No, I don't. I hope I'm doing my bit for sociology students, but I genuinely do think that that what young people get driven by and what they're told to do is to achieve individually. And I have nothing against individual success. For me, it's the way that it's being done, that individual success is often done at the expense of others. And I don't think that many people today have a very good sense of collective action and solidarity, that to get ahead they feel that they need to stomp on others.
Where are we going? Where's that coming from? Like, are we doing it wrong in school and families? Where are they getting that from?
I guess it has just been a general shift in neoliberal understandings of how things are done. That it's about the individual. The individual must succeed, and you know, certainly, if we take it away from just that individual example, that there's a belief in the trickle down effect, that if great things happen at the top, they're somehow going to filter down, and certainly in my experience of South Africa, I haven't seen that happening. That better and more sustainable things seem to happen when they're built from the bottom up. And even if they fall apart, people learn from those mistakes, you know, rather than the supposed trickle-down effect that private and corporate entities are somehow going to give back to the poor.
So what would we have to do to turn around that drive to succeed, but individually, into a drive to succeed as a collective?
If you want the answer that I really believe in, we're fundamentally going to have to unpack and get rid of capitalism. But I'm not really sure that that's a discussion I want to get into now. I mean, a capitalist system thrives on inequality. And until we start to understand that there can't really be capitalism with a good face, I think it's very difficult to sort of overcome that idea of the individual comes first and everybody else comes him second.
What challenges do you have for the next couple of years?
Oh, I mean, professionally, my first challenge is being employed full time at the university. at the moment, I'm there part time, so that would be one of the big things. And also, you know, I would like to branch out my teaching so that some of these things that we've discussed this evening sort of fall into my teaching profile.
What about in your research goals?
I would like to continue this work on resource scarcity. Again, my particular interest is on water. But I'm also particularly keen on seeing an African studies network developing at the University of Otago, and certainly some of the people that I've spoken to, that there's a fair amount of interest in developing such a network. I think there are a lot of Africanists who are, all sort of spread out on the campus in public health, history, geography, etc. And I think it would be good to pull those people together and have a focused sort of effort on African studies.
And in terms of changing the world, do you just want to bring down capitalism?
If only it were that easy.
Do you have an alternative?
You know, again, it's one of those things that I feel like I'm now going to have to say the S word. And that being socialism, and I think that, you know, it's sort of a topic for another day, that it's not sort of state socialism that I'd be behind. I get the issues with state socialism, but I think what is worth exploring is more democratic forms of socialism. Maybe we don't have to call it socialism, you know, maybe a whole nother word needs to be used. But certainly, I don't think we can continue. The world will continue. We know that, but it's you know, whether or not we want it to continue in this way, that I find to be the issue. I don't think it is sustainable.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners? Anything you'd like to see them do?
I guess it is to ask those questions about New Zealand's resources and to confront the issue of what role does a small nation, quite a remote nation like New Zealand, what role does it have to play? And perhaps consider that question that you'd posed earlier about is it right as citizens having to buy back something that citizens already own?
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who didn't manage to turn up, but we understand where he is and we hope everybody's all right. I'm sure they are. And me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest was Dr. Marcel Dawson from the University of Otago Department of Sociology and some other things. We are broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. You can find us on Facebook and various other places. You can listen to us on iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.